I want to welcome you guys to R-Bop. This is Riddick's Book of Philosophy. My name's Philip Riddick, and this is where I talk about what I want to talk about the way I want to talk about it. If you enjoy this podcast, tell your friends, family, and loved ones to come in and enjoy my whimsical way of saying things, doing things, and thinking about things.
Please hold for a very important message.
Hey, everybody. Sooner or later, you're going to have to travel. You're going to have to take a plane, a hotel, or rent a car or something, either because you want to go on a vacation, something that you were waiting for, or really wanted to do. Or sometimes we have some unfortunate circumstances in our families where we have to travel involuntarily. Either way or the other, if you need to travel, you want to save some money. I am an independent TSA travel savings ambassador for iBoomerang. And I can save you 30 to 70% on your travel. If you send me your first and last name to the following email address, dcboomgetaways@gmail.com. Once again, dcboom, B-U-U-M, getaways@gmail.com. I can send you an absolutely free website, yours personally, that you can use whenever you want, and it will save you money. It can save your money whenever you are going away. You might be going away now. You might be going away in the future. This website is yours forever. But once again, if you want to save money traveling 30 to 70%, shoot your first and last name to me at dcboom, B-U-U-M, getaways@gmail.com. Welcome to R-Bop. Welcome to R-Bop. My name is Phil. I'm the hostess with the mostest. And I am fantastic, y'all. You know. Put your hands together, guys, for the best host ever. All right. All right, guys. Once again, I want to welcome you to the show. I have a special guest today. This is a very good friend of mine by the name of Jake Meeks. Now, the reason I brought him here, I asked for him to come here, is because we both travel across the world, all over the place. I travel for my reasons. He travels for his. And we're going to get into his journeys and see where this conversation is, how this conversation goes. So, Jake, how you doing, my friend?
Man, I'm doing good. I'm doing all right. Enjoying the beer on a Friday night. So, cool.
So, for those of y'all that can't see, those of y'all listening and not watching, I'm sipping on my cocktail. He got a couple cold ones going back and forth. And yeah, it's a pleasure to have him here. So I'd like for you to introduce yourself, man. Just your introduction. Where are you? Where are you from? What's your background?
Sure, man. I'll do my best. I'll give the broad outline because I know we're going to go into detail in a bit. Mm-hmm. But my name's Jake. I grew up in a small town in Wyoming, like 500 people. You blink, you miss the town, that kind of thing. and that's true, too. It takes you 10 seconds to cruise Maine. Right. I left there when I was 18, 19, joined the Army. That's where I met Phil, which I still find it strange to call you Phil because I see you and I want to call you Sergeant Riddick because that's just what's like in my brain. So it's just weird to call you Phil. I did Fort Bragg for 4 years. After that, I got out. The VA paid for my college. I got my bachelor's, my master's. And then for the last 10 years, I've worked for an international nonprofit. For about seven years of that, I lived outside of the U.S. in various places. Nice. So, I mean, from countries in Africa to countries in the Middle East. All over the place.
Beautiful. Beautiful. I know you wanted me to graze over the family thing. So, you know.
I'm on my own. I just turned 40 and I'm on my own. So that's the way it is.
What? You're not looking for nobody, man? Come on.
Man. I was traveling for a long time. I think I've finally come to the point where I might settle down. So we'll see.
Oh, now that's interesting. We'll talk about that offline. Now, for those of you, he mentioned the Army. I want to hear your view on this, Jake. When we first met, when I showed up, we first met, how was that for you?
I'll be honest with you, boss, because I saw, I mean, you sent me the outline before we did this. So I was trying to remember, like, when we first met, right. like that exact moment. And I don't think I have it in my head. I just knew that we were getting a new platoon sergeant. And they said that this guy was coming from Alpha Company, if I remember right.
Right, right.
And I was just like, I hope he's not a dick. that was my only thought, you know, because we had been through a lot of platoon sergeants. Some of them were dicks, some of them weren't.
Right.
And yeah, you weren't a dick. So I was like, oh, he's a good guy.
That's together for not being a dick. That's awesome. I don't know. I mean, I remember when I first got to Delta Company, and, you know, I spoke to the company commander, Captain Gonzalez. I spoke to First Sergeant, and I met you guys. And I was that guy, if you remember or not, I was standing off to the side. I forget who the platoon sergeant was. Was it Sergeant Jones in the front at the time? Had you lost
platoon sergeant? It might have been Sergeant Farron. It was either Sergeant Farron or Sergeant Jones.
Okay. And I just kind of stood off to the side for a while, but then I was getting those crazy looks because I, you know me, I showed up with all the scare me badges and shit, you know, blah, blah, blah. And yeah. And then, you know, obviously I came from a line company. I wasn't a hotel at all. For those of you that don't know, a hotel are the motorized guys. Okay. The ones that fight trucks. I came from a dismounted guy to a motorized platoon. Not going to get into why. That'll be another podcast. So I had things to learn about how to do that, but you guys had things to learn because I came in straight leg infantry. My brain was different.
It was a bit different, yeah.
Yeah, we were. I mean, if you think, we trained differently from the other platoons. We did a lot of dismounted stuff where other platoons didn't do as much, and you guys were pissed. But it paid off once we got into combat. You know, once we started going places to, yeah, engagements. But anywho, next question. Yeah.
I mean, I do actually, before you even go on, I wanted to tell you my favorite Sergeant Riddick story, if I can. Okay. I mean, it may not be my favorite. I mean, I don't know if it's my favorite story, but I'm going to tell the story anyway. Okay. And you can tell me if I'm right, because you know how we haven't seen each other in what, like 17 years now?
About that, yeah.
And you know, when you tell a story so many times, then you're not sure if it actually happened anymore. You're like, I think that happened. I like telling the story, but I'm not sure if it was like that.
I understand.
So anyway, it was right before we went to Afghanistan, and you gave this speech to the platoon, and you were like, men, you know, I want to go to war with you guys. And the reason why I want to go to war is because I know certain things about you. And then you went down the line and you were like, yeah, Simpy, I know you country as hell. And then you went to Holyfield and you're like, Holyfield, because I know you got a big, he was well endowed.
All right.
And then you went to Bobby and you were like, Bobby, because you quick to beat a motherfucker's ass.
Right.
And then you came to me, and I was the last one, I think, and you were like, Meeks? Yeah, Meeks? He's just the one guy that doesn't give a fuck about anything.
I remember that.
Everybody started laughing because it was like, oh, yeah, that makes sense.
He called it. And there's a reason for that. The reason I did that is because not only do you need to know your people, especially if you go into a stressful situation, you need to let your people know that you know them. You know what you can expect from people. You know, if I need somebody to kick somebody's ass, I'm calling Bobby Aller. Yeah, if I need somebody that's going to freaking, you know, thump somebody up, I'm calling freaking Sergeant Jones. You know, if I need, yeah, that's right.
Not if you need a diplomat, though.
No, I don't. If I need a diplomat, I need freaking Macarenas. You know what I'm saying? I just needed at that time to let all of you guys know we're going to war and I want to go with you guys. And this is why everybody has tools that's going to make us all successful. It might not have came out. You might not have thought of it that way when I gave that talk, but that was the purpose for that talk. Okay.
No, I think I internalized it for sure.
Yeah. It's funny because I remember it now and you're spot on. I ran through the whole freaking platoon, but you know, things where you don't think about it, a story just comes up and then you're like, oh, I remember. So yeah. Thank you for that, man. I appreciate it. All right, we're going to move on. You say you don't do a lot of social media, so I'm going to skip that question right there. But now what do you do specifically? Well, not what you're doing now, because I know you're moving on to something different. But what have you done the most specifically for a living, your job?
I mean, it's a long story, but I've worked for, it's an international nonprofit. Their name is Mercy Corps, not to be confused with Peace Corps. Okay. I mean, I got paid like a wage, you know?
Yeah.
And they do different development and humanitarian projects all over the world. I mean, that's the easiest way to say it. I could say it more particularly from, like, I was in a village in rural South Sudan for a year and a half, was my first job, like 2010, 2011. And we were building everything from schools to poultry houses. And I ran operations there. So that meant I was in charge of all the support functions, basically, because you have a programmatic function that goes out and helps the people or figures out what to do and has like community discussions and whatnot. Mm-hmm. And then you have your support functions, which is basically like being a platoon sergeant in the army without the bullets is a good way to think about it.
Right.
Because then you're supplying all the stuff, you're managing the fleets, you're managing the compound, like all of that. And that was my job then. Later on, you know, when I was in Jordan and Lebanon, all our programs were centered around the Syrian refugee crisis, because this is around 2012 to 2015.
Okay.
So we did a lot of work in like Zaatari camp, for instance, which is in northern Jordan. It was the biggest and the first of the refugee camps in Jordan.
Wow.
So we put in water there. We drilled a well and put in a water system. They did a lot of psychosocial support programming for children, like building playgrounds and whatnot. Because, I mean, it ends up being like a city, basically, where people live and they can't leave. And Lebanon was similar. Only the political situation in Lebanon is different. So they don't have formalized camps, per se, like they do in Jordan. Right. It's rather kind of these makeshift camps where we also support with water and things like that.
Now, this was between wars, between U.S. conflicts, or was it pretty tame?
No, I mean, none of this was U.S. conflict. The Syrian conflict, I mean, that's all a fallout from the Syrian civil war.
Right.
I mean, and I wasn't inside Syria, and that's where the conflict is.
Gotcha.
And so, yeah, I mean, that was fairly tame.
So it was just refugees moving away from those trouble spots.
It was refugees moving away from those trouble spots. Yeah.
Nice.
Both going south to Jordan and then going west to Lebanon. Okay. Man, I mean, the war has been going on for 10 years now.
So. Ever.
And yeah, it's a fucking horrible thing, man. In South Sudan, we were, so in South Sudan, like, they've been in civil war for what, 7-8 years now. I was there before when it was still part of Sudan, which was one country.
Right,
so
right.
I went through the whole time of them separating and whatnot. And we were in a border area and it was a little dicey from time to time, but, I mean, it is what it is.
Gotcha.
Yeah, man. And then, after that, like, I came back to the States for a couple years, did some work for them over here. Just like some systems work, because this is a big organization. We're talking like 5,000-6,000 people all over the world, you know, and we're talking like $1 billion over the course of a year. And then 2018, I spent a lot of time in Northeast Nigeria, and I was doing security for the organization, but that's not what you think it is. I mean, it's not like I had a gun or anything. That's what everybody thinks when I say security. It's more about risk assessments and risk analysis and what kind of programming, how we safely do our programming in any given area. Yeah.
And this
is in Northeast Nigeria where they've had a conflict, Boko Haram.
Matter of fact, that's where those girls were captured, right?
Yeah. Yeah. You know, a place called the Chibok. Yeah.
I got you. In the chat, we got, people speaking, Johnny Max, Leprechaun TV, Terry Schweikhart, Ray Haggard. Remember Ray?
Oh, I remember Haggard.
Ray's in there. He says, looking good, man. He says, you're looking good. I got a few people, quite a few people from our old unit, you know, that's still on my Facebook. I argue with most of them.
Yeah, I know. I read all the time, man. You guys go back and forth.
I love them to death, but sometimes we just don't see eye to eye. Now, just so they'll know, hey, I'll kill a motherfucker over anybody that I've served with in a heartbeat. If you need me, I'm there. Even if we don't see eye to eye all the time. All right, let's move on to the next question. Let's talk about the whole world traveling thing, because that's why that's what the podcast is about, the world traveling thing. What caused you to start work? I mean, we traveled abroad a little bit, but we were, you know, trying to shoot people and blow shit up. But what caused you to continue on that path to work abroad after you got out of military?
So two things. Okay. And I've thought about this a lot. But when I went to college, my first degree, my bachelor's degree, was in business. And by the time I got to the end of it, I think it was 2007, and I was under a voc rehab program, VA program. Mm-hmm. And I go to my counselor and I'm like, man, I don't think with my temperament the way it is right now, I can go work for corporate America. I think that would be a problem.
I didn't have nothing to do with that, did I? The military?
Son Jones, maybe. But if he was here, yes, he had something to do with it. I'd be totally free about that. Okay. But you know, you're good. But yeah, so I told him, and he was an older Vietnam vet, and he was like, look, man, you're finishing your program early. If you want to try to do a master's degree, go ahead. I'll extend your time the little bit extra I would need to finish that program. And I was like, cool, let me do that, because I can't go work for a business. So he was really cool about it. He gave me more time.
Right.
I discovered this whole NGO thing doing my master's degree. And I kind of decided, I mean, I was a bit fed up with people by that point. And it was because I felt, and I'd be curious to hear what you think, but I felt when we were in the Army and we were in Afghanistan, or I was in Kosovo before doing peacekeeping, like we were in somebody else's country, in America, in their country. You know, it's like we brought America with us. I mean, yes. We hung out with each other. You know, we watched all the shows, like we were together. We weren't really in their country. We were in a little part of America that we made in their country.
Yeah.
And maybe it's selfish on my part, but I wanted to see other people's culture through their eyes as much as I could.
Me too.
I thought that was really important. Yeah.
I agree. Now, to your point, whenever we deployed, and I've deployed more than you have, whenever we deployed, we come in, jump, fly, land, however we get there, and then we make a base, a post, an outpost, something, and it's all ours. Okay. You people stay out. No matter the country, this is ours. And then we Americanize the shit. Even if we take over, let's name them, Kandahar, Dahran, we jump in, take over an airfield, go to those places now, man.
They're TGIF and Burger King and all this shit. Yeah, I've heard stories.
Yeah, and I've gone back to Kandahar, CAF. I've been back to Bagram. Dude, it's just a carved out piece of America. You know, you allow, this is weird, you allow the people from their country into your peace.
Yeah. Yeah.
like they're visitors, you know. America's terrible at that. And then, you know, we got it all freaking bunkered in or walled in or whatever. Now we'll go out and shoot people, and then we're going back to our piece of America that we carved out in their country.
Yeah.
And can't understand why they're fucking pissed. We just get they have the nerve to attack us in our post. Dude, you're in their country. They're pissed. Anyway.
I'm with you. I 100%.
We do that all the time. Speaking of not traveling, we'll stay on this for a second. Name one place that we have invaded, we as the American country, the United States of America, that we have left. I can't think of very many. Go all the way back to the freaking Korean War.
I'm thinking.
We're still in Korea. We fought Germany. We're still in Germany.
Oh, I skipped back to like the 1800s. I was thinking like late 1800s and see what I could think of.
Dude,
but even the ones that I could say that maybe we're not there anymore, we're still there.
We have even a presence.
Not in a military sense, like in an economic sense, big time. So
the United States doesn't leave anywhere. They don't. Philippines, we're there. Germany, we're there. France, we're there. Come on, man. We're everywhere. Yeah. Japan, we're still there. Anyway, that's not what we're here to talk about. Okay. How did you learn to adapt into this field? You know, I mean, you already talked about your degrees and all of that, but techniques, training, what honed your skills to get into what you're doing now?
I wish I could say that something honed my skills and it wasn't more. I mean, I'll be honest, man, like the international aid world, and it's gotten better over time. It's gotten a lot better.
Right.
But I could say that 10 years ago, the fact I'll be perfectly fucking honest, the fact that I was going to the poorest country in Africa at that time, the fact that I am white and American.
Right.
That was almost, and the fact that I had been in the military, quite honestly, because they knew that because I'd been in the military and they had seen my record, they knew I wasn't just going to quit. They knew I'd be able to handle whatever was going to come.
Right. Right.
A lot of that combined with my education and the fact that I smooth talked as much as I could got me that job. And I will say, I mean, and I don't want it to reflect too badly on my organization either, because everybody I worked with, like when we work in a country, 95% of our staff are from that country, right?
Right.
And then you've got like 5% expats, maybe depending on size and a lot of different things. Mm-hmm. And the expat just means somebody that's not from the country. So like everybody I worked with in South Sudan, I mean, they were all African from other countries, whether it was Kenya or Liberia or wherever, pretty much everybody on my base. Mm-hmm. My brain might go off on a
tangent. Let it fly, man. This is that type of podcast. Do you think, baby?
I mean, that's basically how I ended up, is that I kind of sweet talked my way. I had a couple of benefits in terms of adaptation. Again, because it was South Sudan, and like people know in the aid world, that's where people go on their first mission. I mean, it's not the easiest place to work.
Wow.
In fact, it's probably one of the hardest fucking places to work in the world.
I didn't know that.
Well, yeah. I mean, South Sudan, I give you the whole history, but like, yeah. It's difficult, and it's remote where I was. I was living in my tent, which I had a good tent, man. I had a nice carpet in the tent for, you know, like 18 months. That really held the tent together. But in terms of, like, training or anything, not really, man. I was in Juba, which is the capital, for, like, 2 weeks between Christmas and New Year's, 2009-2010. Right. And we were just kind of hanging out because we didn't want to go to the field during Christmas because they were worried about security.
Okay.
And then I get on a plane and I get on a normal size like UN plane. And I fly to this place called WAU, W-A-U. Wow.
Okay. Okay.
And it was weird, man, because we land in this normal size plane and we're on like a dirt runway. And I look to the side of me and I see two full size like Boeings, but they're broke. And like one, the tail is sticking out of the dirt like an airplane graveyard, you know?
Yeah.
And I'm like, what the fuck?
We're going to die.
And then we get on a smaller plane, like a small 12-seater Cessna, you know?
Yeah.
And we fly out to the bush and we land on a dirt runway. And it's like the guys, and part of me hates telling this story because people are so fucking ignorant and they think like all of Africa is poor, like I'm describing now, which is just insane. You know, it's 54 countries, but like this was a very rural place.
Right.
So we land on this dirt airstrip and they got to clear the goats off. It was something I used to have to do. You have to clear the goats off the airstrip so the plane can land. Otherwise the UN pilots, they get pissed off and they wouldn't land if they saw the goats and the cows out there.
Now, wait. Real quick, is that because if you killed the goat, you had to pay reparations for the goat, or is it because it was a danger to the aircraft?
Well, the reason they didn't land, so yes, on both counts.
Okay.
The reason they didn't land was because it was a danger to the aircraft, but yes, if I was to hit a goat, which I have a couple stories about, I had to pay reparations for said goat. So anyway, man, I get there, and we land on the dirt runway, and they drive us to the compound. And I mean, nobody handed me shit. It was like it was a compound where we didn't have like money. Nobody had bought food. They had these old Land Cruisers that they were pushing to start them because nobody had bought batteries for the vehicles.
Really?
And my boss was, well, and it's a very particular time. Like it doesn't reflect so badly on him. It was just the moment I got there, you know.
I got you. I understand.
And my boss, she was with me, and she was supposed to stay with me for a couple of weeks, you know, to like walk me through everything, what to do. Right. And then we had an emergency in one of her other bases, so she leaves me after 2 days. It's like, here you go, motherfucker. You're either going to sink or swim, so figure it the fuck out.
Tread water, bitch.
Yeah.
That's amazing.
That was my learning experience. So they never sent me to an orientation. The organization's got a lot better over the years, and they're very professional about it now.
Right, right.
And they've asked me because I've left and I've come back, and they're like, hey, man, we'll send you an orientation. I'm like, fuck you. What are you going to orient on me on now?
Now, have you ever got new people that you had to get oriented?
Oh, a million. I mean, yes. A million okay. times.
So I'm sure, based on lessons learned, you gave them a better welcome in than that you moving goats and you got.
Oh, yeah. No, I've oriented both. I mean, I've oriented people from anywhere in the world, you know?
Nice.
So
leading to my next question. Your inspiration. What inspired you to do this? On top of what inspired you to do this, what kept you doing this for so long?
So inspiration, I feel like, it was literally just that. It was like, I felt like here in America, we can be very narrow fucking minded about the rest of the world. Yes, I mean, narrow minded about our own country, but.
Oh, we're the worst. We're the freaking worst, man.
We kind of suck when it comes to geography and culture and these things. Yes. I mean, like understanding other people's culture.
Right. Now, let me say this. Greatest country in the world, but the United States of America is also greatly fucked up. We are.
Yeah.
We're a great place. I love this place. I fought for this place. I bled for this place. And I would never be anywhere else. But we are completely fucked up on some things.
Yeah. Okay. And I just second
that.
Too.
Off my chest.
totally second that and with you. Like, I love this place, too. I always come back home in the end. Yeah. But that doesn't mean I can't say that we're fucked up about some things.
Oh, yeah. We're terrible. Anyway, you were saying.
So, yeah, I mean, it was literally to try to understand other people's cultures. Mm-hmm. And to try to understand why we did some of the things that we did in the world and like how that affected other people.
Yeah.
And I don't know if you remember from the Army, but I can be a bit cynical about the world.
Yes.
I can have a slightly cynical worldview.
9 times out of 10, Jake was Jake. But that 10th time, I'll be like, this dude don't fucking get it. You were Jake, and I loved you for it, and I learned from it. And that's part of the reason why I hold you so close. I've never lost you after all these years. There's so many people I don't give a flying fuck about, man. There's people I don't even try to contact, but we've always maintained contact over the years. Hey, boss, I'm doing this. Can you hook me up? Yeah. Hey, Jake, how you doing, brother? You know, we're not the worst of friends. We're not the best of friends, but you're someone that my life would be different if I didn't have. Not trying to kiss your ass or nothing, but
no,
you know,
I feel the same way. Yeah,
you're one of the I don't want to call you a thing, but you're one of the things that I hold dear, if that makes sense to you. My life would be different without Jake Meeks.
That's a big weight. I know my life would be different without you, because I would have had Sergeant Jones for a platoon sergeant, and I'd probably be dead right now.
But my thing is, as far as appreciation, understanding, and things that kind of center me, and it's not a big weight, but you're one of the people that kind of center me. We don't speak a lot, but when we do speak, it's about something of substance and important, if that makes any sense. Now I'm going to make things a little bit lighter and move on to the next question.
Well, I don't think I had finished my answer to the last question. But
okay.
I
no, no, let it go. So, go. What would you call? I didn't mean to interrupt you.
Well, no, it was inspiration. Oh, yeah, an inspiration. I was saying basically the same as I said before. Why I stayed?
Yeah.
Partially because I just wasn't done with it yet. Partially because I didn't really have a fucking plan once I started. I was like, okay, I'm going to start doing this. And then I just kept doing it, like many things in life. So.
Or just not done until I'm done.
Yeah.
That's great. Outstanding. Now, and this isn't even on the outline, just in your travels, because I'm a foodie, and I like to interact with the culture. That's one thing that I hate about, you know, being working where I work in parts unknown and being in the military, not hated being in the military, but that situation where, you know, somebody's the good guy, somebody's the bad guy. Now, that's all based on perception. You know what I'm saying? It's based on perception. But in the military, we have our camps, like we alluded to earlier, where we're here and we can't do stuff. We're the bad guy or the good guy, whatever. And in some places, because of the world's situations in the world, the Americans are behind walls when you're in foreign countries, specifically in the Middle East and places that are a little bit more hostile, where you have to be there. You know, you're on a camp or a post or a FOB, or you're in an embassy or something. You're behind the wall. You can't enjoy the culture, you know, the food, the people, the music. How
well, and that wasn't difficult the case for
was
me.
That was my question. Was that difficult for you, or could you do that?
Yeah, I could do that. Okay. It depends. So, I mean, obviously, it depends on the place and the security level. So when I was in the Middle East, for example, I was in Jordan and Lebanon, and right. they were both stable, relatively stable. Jordan's mm-hmm. sleepy little country in the middle of a bunch of craziness around it. Yeah. And then Lebanon, I mean, it has its moments. But, yeah, I lived in my own apartment. Like, there was a KFC and a Starbucks, you know, right down the road from me.
In Lebanon.
I wouldn't recommend the KFC, but yeah, in Beirut. Okay. Which is funny, man. I'll talk to Americans sometime and they'll be like, oh, you were living in the desert. I'm like, no, not even close. Yeah. I mean, and Beirut is a party city anyway. I mean, it's the Paris of the Middle East, they like, or some people okay. say.
Right.
And I love Lebanese food. I mean, in terms of like just food, right? That's where I would want to go eat. Nice. About the places that I've been. So there I was pretty free. When I was in both South Sudan, mostly because of the remoteness and there was really nowhere to go. I mean, we had to drive 6 hours to buy toilet paper back then. I'm not bullshitting you at all on that. I mean, that's drive time.
No, I laugh because of the toilet paper, because with this whole freaking virus thing, you can find toilet paper anywhere. You can drive 6 hours if you want to.
Oh, yeah. No, we buy like 6 months supply at once and be done with it. So there was because of the remoteness. When I was in Nigeria, for example, I was in the Northeast.
Yes.
And there, yeah, I would have to take a chopper, like a UN helicopter, because you couldn't take the roads out to these small little remote bases. Wow. Where all our staff were Nigerian, and they would send me out for like 4 or 5 days to work with them on security and whatnot.
Right.
There was nowhere to go either, really. once you made it out to the field, there's nowhere to go. Not really. There were security concerns there as well, particularly because I stick out, you know, in there.
Okay.
Most of the time, and everybody I worked with generally was like from that place. So all right. my personal interactions would be with people that are from there. So,
which is beautiful. Now, meeting people around the world, much as I have, what's your take on this? This is a broad freaking question. What is your take on people, in a sense? You know, good, bad. You're the guy. I'm trying to hone this question in here. I'm on the fly here. You're the guy in the foreign country. Now, this applies to all of them, but you're the guy in the foreign country. What's your take on culture? You know what I'm saying? How? Here's the question. 9 times out of 10, how are you received from a different culture? Being a foreigner, you being the guy outsider coming in, how have you been received the majority of the time?
For me, I've always been received well. I'll just say that. And there's a lot of different factors in that.
Yes.
And of course, there's the immediate reaction. And then there's once you know people, too. Okay. I mean, and I think people anywhere, they always have, like, when somebody new comes in or somebody from a different place I mean, it depends on the situation, of course. Then they come in and you wait and you see. And then like, oh, he's okay. He's not a dick. It's fine. The thing that I've thought, and I've talked to like young people going off to do careers and whatnot, and what I always tell them is like, man, people are people. They got the same fucking needs, wants, desires, problems, you know, everywhere in the world. I'll tell you one thing that I know this. I worked with this. He's a bit of a redneck. He's from Colorado, but he was one of those rednecks that apparently when he was young, his father had this old APC, like some old World War II APC. Right. And him and his brother, it was a track vehicle. Him and his brother used to drive that thing to school, right? he'd always be wearing his boots and his shit kickers. And I worked with him in Jordan. He was, Lebanon. He was right. An analyst for it. And Max was telling me once he had been to do his master's dissertation with the Bedouins, which is a pretty remote tribe in the northern part of Jordan.
Okay.
So he lived out with the Bedouins for a long time. He said, you know what the funny thing is? The Bedouins in northern Jordan and the rednecks back home have more in common with each other than either of them will ever have with their ruling classes. But they want to talk shit about each other because they don't understand culture, language, or whatever it is, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
And I mean, that's true. Like,
it is.
Human daily things are the same. Like, oh, you're somebody's cheating on you, or somebody did something bad to you, or you need money to pay the bills, or you got to take care of your kid. That's all the same.
What I found in my travels, what I found is people are the same no matter where you go.
Yeah.
Okay. And, you know, me being, I talked about being a foodie earlier. Poor people food is poor people food. Poor people eat rice. It don't matter the country. Poor people eat beans. It don't matter the country. Poor people going to eat all parts of that animal no matter what country you go to. The richer folks are going to get the better cuts. The poor folks are going to be eating the freaking livers and the kidneys and shit. It all depends on not status. It's just that, you know, where you come from and, you know, what you've achieved. I guess that is status. It all devolves to your status. But no matter what country you go to, poor people are the same. Middle class is the same. Rich people are the same. Language is different. The way you dress is different. The music you listen to is different. But the level of sameness, if that's even a freaking word.
It is now.
It's the same. I admitted that shit. It's the same no matter where you go. People are people.
Yeah. And I mean, that's the biggest thing about the whole thing is just to, I think people can understand it intellectually, like in America, like you can hear you and me talk about it, and like intellectually people get it. People are people, but there's a difference between understanding something intellectually and like feeling it in your bones and just emotions. Knowing.
Yeah.
Emotionally of like, just knowing that wherever I go, people are people. I got to fucking deal with the situation as it is. No big deal. You know, I can find commonality in our humanity. So
beautiful word. Commonality. Everybody knows if you walk down a freaking dark alley, you could get robbed. Everybody knows if you're walking around with money out your pocket, you can get robbed. It doesn't matter where you go in the world. Common sense is common sense. What I don't understand, maybe you can help me with this, is how come there's something, and I'm going to get to this in a later question, how is there so much of a disparity in what some people feel you deserve as opposed to what some people accept what they get. Does that make any sense? You know,
I'm not sure if I'm tracking.
It's, you know, it's just that how to word it. And I'm trying to stay. Well, you know what? Fuck it. I'm just going to go straight into.
Yeah. If I did, why not? Let's just go into
this whole situation in America right now. Okay. And what I'm struggling with, and maybe you can help me, being a world traveler, you being a world traveler, because I see it one way and I'm trying to gauge how you might think about things. You know, there's a status in America right now where some people understand that Black people, people of color, have been downtrodden and they're trying to escape that and move, you know, move to equality. And some people are stuck in the, you're trying to change, you're trying to change shit, leave shit the way it is. What's your take, man? And dive in as deep or not deep as you want. Not trying to put you on the spot or anything.
No, it's good. I mean, I read the questions earlier, so I was thinking about it a little bit. So I don't know if I'm going to answer exactly how just you just phrased
answer it. Answer it how you can.
I mean, one thing I learned about people, and this is broader. I mean, this is separate from America. I'm just going to talk on a broad level for a second. Then I'll get to a thought on America real quick.
All right.
But I mean, broadly, people are tribal. I mean, wherever you go, people are tribal. They always have groups to identify with. And that could be tribe, that could be race, that could be ethnicity, that could be politics.
Yes.
Like, it's a really sad fucking thing about humanity, to be quite honest.
There's always groups. There's going to be groups, yes.
And it's not so bad that there's groups. I mean, that's fine. But it becomes that there's our group, there's us and there's them. And we're battling over scarce resources many times. I mean, that's how it's been, like, historically in some cases.
Yes.
Like, and we're looking at these resources. So if they get these resources, that means we don't have them. So now we're tribalized and we're going to fight. And then all this shit builds out from there, you know, ethnocentrism, racism, like all of this stuff.
Yes.
And I don't know that we can last as people in the same cycle that we've always been in, particularly when we live in a time where we've had all these technological advancements and all this is going on, but we still have these deep rooted us and them mentalities, which I just don't think is fucking workable.
How can we be so smart and intelligent and so stupid as a people at the same fucking time? I don't get it.
I mean, it's the I don't know, man. I mean, I know a lot of people that are they can be geniuses on one thing, but then they're a fucking idiot on something else. So I guess that's humanity as a whole.
It is.
Yeah. I mean, in the America thing, man, so much has gone on. Yeah, I don't know how to best phrase it, but I would say that we're not able to have all the conversations that we need to, and that we're not able to look at things realistically and like, oh, historically, this is what happened to Black people here, 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 and here. These are the structures that have been built up. We can acknowledge these things as bad and wrong and not morally right. How do we dismantle them? I mean, how does that work? And if for whatever reason that we have not been able to have that conversation on a holistic enough level yet, I mean, with everybody involved.
I agree.
Maybe, I don't know.
No, I agree with you completely in what you said. And I'll reiterate, I'm talking about the United States as a whole, for some reason, cannot have a holistic conversation. There are so many people. Some Black people are freaking resistant. Oh, they did us wrong. Fuck them. And then white people are like, I wasn't a slave master. I wasn't there. Fuck them. You know, there's so many dynamics to denial, acceptance, what we want, what we're going to get. There's so many pieces in there. I agree with you. We, at this point, cannot have the holistic, operative word, holistic conversation. Now, I think because of everything that's going on right now, we're moving to a place, I ain't gonna say better place, we're moving to a place where the conversation is starting to come out more. But when you have people, I would say it, when you people at higher levels that are resistant, it's counterproductive.
Yeah, and when and when those people are being voted for again and again.
Because,
I mean, and that's the thing. I don't want to get political either, but like
trying so hard.
I know, but it's if people say that the vote doesn't matter, that politicians suck, which I agree on some level. But at the same time, like they have platforms, they have directions they want to go. And even if a small step in the right direction is better than a step in the wrong direction, it is important. Like it just is.
We'll get there. I think we'll get there. It might not. I'll put it like this. Black people have been fucked up for 400 years. It might take 400 years to unfuck it. I don't know. I'm just saying, as long as people are trying, I'm happy. we're gonna move on. This got heavy, and this is supposed to be light.
Yeah, no, I was like, man, I thought I was gonna tell you funny stories and shit.
I know, man. I told you, though, I don't know how this conversation was gonna go. It just went. What's in your future, my friend? What are you working on? What are your plans?
So I am. I left Mercy Corps actually today. Funnily enough, is my last official day.
Okay.
With the agency, and I've been with them for the better part of 10 years. On Monday, and I've had a bit of time, but on Monday I'll start with Team Rubicon. Team Rubicon is so they started 10 years ago. They're veteran founded, and they've taken veteran volunteers, basically. They started with veteran and first responder volunteers in the U.S., and they do hurricane response, natural disaster response.
Okay.
Utilizing volunteers in like the beginning parts. They're a young organization. They've grown to about 250, maybe 280 paid staff now.
Right.
I'm going to be their disaster operations planning manager. So all their major disaster operations, because they have different regions. It's like veteran FEMA. So they have their regions and they have their leaders and they go respond to whatever's going on, whether it's flood, tornado, or whatever. The more major stuff like the hurricanes and whatnot, I'll be heavily involved in the planning process for those. And how we're gonna respond.
Congratulations.
And I think, yeah, thank you. And I think part of the reason they hire me is because they're looking at going more international, and I have quite a bit of international experience, so it does make some sense.
Due to the lack of international travel, I'm kind of homeward bound. So if they hire it. Hook me up, brother.
I'll let you know. You're not the first person that said that to me either.
Yes, indeed. But, man, we're cruising in at 49 minutes. We probably make it to an hour. Man, like I always say in my YouTube channel, I love you like cooked food, but I literally no shit look you in the eye. I love you like a brother. If there's anything you need from me. Don't hesitate to ask. You know me better than many. Even after all these years, you know me better than many.
We don't change that much. I've noticed that in like all the I've been to a reunion or two. Well, one when Franco when he was passing.
Right.
There was a bunch of guys there. And I think we all realized that when we were talking, we hadn't seen each other in 15 years. At that point, and it was like, oh, yeah, we're still the same fucking people, man.
Yeah.
The same people. And same goes for you. If you ever need anything, I got you, boss. I'll do what I can.
I appreciate you, man. But, man, I appreciate you. Close me out, man. What else you got to say? Anything important? A message to the world?
A message to the world? Don't be a dick. That's
how it is. Wait. There you go.
I mean, I've had to manage people. I mean, I've managed people of all different nationalities, and I've been managed by people of all different nationalities, genders, everything. And it's just like, be nice to people. Find the human commonality. Like, it's not fucking rocket science, man. And don't let your own perceptions interfere with the relationship, you know?
Yeah, dignity and respect. Treat people with dignity and respect, and they will treat you with dignity and respect. That's what I found over my years in the military and my travels. You know, don't be a dick. Like you said, if you treat people right, they will want to treat you right.
Yeah. And then for all the Americans listening, I will say one thing, you know, and I can't knock on Americans too much for this because I'm totally fucking guilty. I was living in Poland with my ex, and this is like 2011 after South Sudan. And I've been living in Warsaw for like 3-4 months. And it occurred to me one day that I couldn't point to the country on a map, and that I didn't really know where I was.
Right.
And Americans, we are geographically challenged when it comes to other countries. And I think we got to remember that we're only 5% of the world's population. And it's really good to chill out our Amerocentrism, like everything revolves around us. And geography is the way to start.
It is. Now, a question from the chat. You got Mona. Tira Mona says, what's your favorite country or culture?
I've had that one asked a few times, and I'm never quite sure how to respond because it was always dependent on like when I was there and why I was there, you know? Okay. So I'd say the favorite place that I lived, and I mean live, like I was there for 2 years was Beirut in Lebanon. I'll be honest why. The food is good. Lebanese women are beautiful. And there is, I mean, yeah, the people are great. I mean, Beirut's got its problems. Lebanon's got its problems, but I did enjoy my time there. And the Lebanese I've found, because they've been through a lot historically, are the one people that I always make this joke with my Lebanese friends. It's like, they're the one people I know where a bomb could be going off over there and they still be dancing and fucking partying over here. You know, they're just like, it's fine. It didn't hit us. And I had a great trip to Italy once, I would say. Yeah, Italian food's great. It's good. But I mean, I've had good times and met interesting people everywhere. I mean, hell, Nigeria, even though I was in one of the harder parts of Nigeria, I didn't get to see Lagos, which I really wanted to do. Mm. But I mean, there's so much culture. You know, there's great Nigerian authors and just.
Yes.
And there's a lot of culture there. So I've tried to take as much as I can from everywhere I've been. Like,
yeah, man. And shoot, being a world traveler, I'll tell you the place I've enjoyed the most out of being anywhere, and it's going to sound weird, is the Kyrgyz Republic, right below Kazakhstan. Dude, beautiful people.
I can see that. I've heard, man, I've actually heard things.
Right next to China, I was there for about a year and a half, almost 2 years, and the people were friendly. The women were beautiful, and it was just great food, great culture, very friendly. You could go anywhere, and let me back up. Let me say this. The crime rate was so low, it barely rated. You with me? You can't say that anywhere in America.
No.
You can't say that. And I'm from Chicago, the murder capital of the fucking world. Now, and you can put me in a country where even if you have an altercation with the police, they're going to be like, why are you here? What was the problem? Well, I'm here because of this, and that guy was doing this, and I did this, blah, blah, blah. Well, you need to leave. You ain't getting a black guy. In Chicago? Come on, man. You ain't getting, you need to leave. You got the right to remain silent. Bam, 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 maybe.
Yeah, and you know, man, that's one of these things about America, I don't know, Americanism, I guess, is that we think we're the best at everything. And it's like, can you just look at how other people do shit, please? Because, I mean, you can see, like, police shooting rates in somewhere in Europe. It was like, I can't remember the country off the top of my head, but there was like one police involved shooting in like 20 years or some shit. And it's like, are you telling me people are that much different here? No.
Listen, I've been in countries where, you know, if you do this, this or this, the police might show up and thump you up a little bit and then they're going to take you home. Yeah. America, as a black guy, dude, you got the right to be careful. In this motherfucker, but we're not going to get in that. Thank you so much, Jake. I appreciate you, man. Everybody, I'm glad you guys came. Listen to this conversation. If there is something valuable, please leave comments. I'll answer those comments. Jake, I love you like a brother, man.
Love you too, man. Thank you for having me.
Thank you for being here. And everybody, we are out of here. And Jake, don't close yet. We're going to be out of here, guys, in 5, 4, 3, 2, 1. Love you like cooked food, and you guys take care. The podcast is gone.